Daniel Berrigan is a Jesuit priest, a political activist, and a leading figure in the Catholic left. He and his brother Philip Berrigan were the first Roman Catholic priests to receive federal sentences in America for anti-war activism. That was during the war in Vietnam. The Berrigans both committed acts of civil disobedience, briefly went underground, and served time in prison. Since the war in Vietnam, the Berrigans have continued their anti-war activism. In 1980, they were part of the Plowshares 8, a group which committed civil disobedience by entering a General Electric re-entry division assembly site in Pennsylvania. They damaged the nose cones of two nuclear warheads with hammers, then poured their blood on blueprints and tools. They were convicted and are now appealing the case. Although Daniel Berrigan is still considered something of a renegade within the church, he remains a Jesuit and lives in a small Jesuit community in Manhattan. He now works at an AIDS hospice in Greenwich Village, ministering to the terminally ill. Daniel Berrigan has written a new autobiography titled To Dwell in Peace. I spoke with him from the NPR Bureau in New York. In his new book, he tells how he hated Catholic school. He thought of it as a theater of cruelty. I asked Berrigan why he went on to pursue a religious life.
I was very taken by the idea of community, and also I love books and study and teaching, and it seemed as though the Jesuits had all those requirements, and it was very, very fortunate I went ahead with that. I think it's been good for me and good for them too.
You've described yourself as a late bloomer. And you describe yourself being ill and in the hospital when America dropped the atom bomb on Hiroshima and reading about it in the newspaper and that being somehow a pivotal point in your life.
I think it was, even though, of course, at the time I couldn't realize where it was going to take me. But I just had a dreadful feeling, almost as though that bomb had gone off within me. And I think knew obscurely at that point that this was going to blast a lot of suppositions that I had had about what we might call normal living or normal priesthood or normal Jesuit. And that all came true.
Well, when that first happened, when you first read about it and you had this feeling that things were going to change in the world and in your life and in how you interpreted your calling, what came next? What was the first change in your life that followed through on that?
Well, I think, as I said, I was a long time trudging through all this and coming to realize something practical rather than something theoretical about it. Mm-hmm. That is to say, it wasn't going to be enough just to stand around and wring one's hands at the enormous changes in the world, the enormous escalation of possible violence. But I had to get through all this business of the course of studies. And when I began teaching in 1946, I tried to introduce the question to classes that I told about in the book there, and found these young people extremely belligerent and pretty well immersed in the Second World War, probably through their homes, but also through the church, and very difficult to break through with the idea that something horrid had happened and something more horrid was on the horizon, and that we'd better look at it, you know. That was very sobering to realize that people much younger than myself were so warlike.
1965 was a real turning point in your life, and in your brother's life as well. Your brother, Philip Berrigan, was expelled from the seminary, I believe
yes.
it was, and he was assigned to a parish in inner-city Baltimore.
Right.
That same year, you were basically exiled to Latin America for your objections to the war in Vietnam. What were your early protests like back in 1965 and before?
Well, it was all kind of pale. I joined Catholic workers here in New York at a vigil and a blockage of the U.S. mission to the U.N. I had heard someone called me and said that the police were brutalizing people who were sitting in there in front of the entrance in objection to the war. And I went down and indeed found that they were doing that. They were stepping on people very deliberately. There was a lot of official malice in the air. And I went down there in my clerical outfit and dog collar, and the whole thing stopped when they saw a priest. They stepped gingerly aside and didn't want to be found in that position before their church. And that was a very interesting lesson. Though I didn't, at that point, sit down. I was just too kind of naive or raw to realize that I should have been right there blocking. Anyway, it went on, and then I joined some students at the Pentagon in 67, and that was my first arrest. I went down there just to support them and then found that I had to join them. That was very good.
That must have given you a sense of the power you could have, that first demonstration when they saw your priestly garments, and things changed when they saw you.
Well, you know, that sort of thing, of course, is cut both ways as things developed in the church, because especially in the later years of the war, I found that Catholics became my toughest congregation or audience of all, and I always knew I was going to have a very rough time appearing in front of them, and that the frenzy of just war was alive and kicking in the Catholic community. And so, as I see it, it worked both ways.
Back in 65, when you and your brother were both reassigned because of your protests against the war, did that make you cynical about the Jesuits, about the church, realizing that you were in some way being punished for your actions for peace, actions you really believed in, and actions that for you followed right from the Bible and from your religious beliefs?
Yeah. No, I don't think I ever had time for cynicism. I can't remember a moment of it. It was a time of very, very deep sorrow and uprooting and a sense of loss and alienation in a way, I mean, physical and psychological. But I sort of had to gather myself and undergo a discipline on the road, which really came down to prayer and to curiosity about this extraordinary opportunity that, you know, it was like being thrown into the briar patch and finding that was a very interesting setting. So I began to keep a diary, which was later published, and that was a great help. So I turned the whole thing around because I had never been to Latin America, and it was an extraordinary experience. I came back worse than ever.
I like the way you put that. Daniel Berrigan is my guest, and he's written an autobiography which is titled To Dwell in Peace. Now, your brother was the first of the two of you to engage in an action of civil disobedience. This was really one of the first acts of civil disobedience in the peace movement against the war in Vietnam.
Right.
It was a group that became known as the Baltimore Four. They poured blood on draft records
right. In
Baltimore. Did you consider participating in that action, that early action of civil disobedience?
As far as I can recall, the issue didn't come up, because if it had come up, I think I would have a much, much clearer recollection of, you know, why I would not have taken part. The question became a serious one for me only after that, towards 68, when we got together as the Catonsville Nine. I think, as far as I recall, Philip went ahead with that first action with three Baltimore friends, without consulting me.
How close were you then? Which was the first of you to enter the priesthood?
Oh, I went in years and years before Philip. He went off to the Second World War and was a decorated officer in Europe. And only...
That's interesting, because you were in the seminary during World War II.
I was all in the seminary, hiding out.
Mm-hmm.
And Philip came home, and of course he'd undergone enormous changes. And we talked a great deal about his future, and he came to visit me a good deal. And he had thought seriously of coming in the Jesuits also, but then they wouldn't guarantee them. We're a very elitist, snooty group. They wouldn't guarantee him any shortage of training and studies because he was older and college graduate and veteran. So he went in the Josephites, who ordained him in 5 years.
Mm-hmm. So let's get back to the Catonsville Nine, mm-hmm. which is an action that you and your brother both participated in. And would you describe what the action was?
Well, we went into a draft board in Catonsville, Maryland, in May of 1968. And two of the felons were repeaters, that Tom Lewis and Philip. And they had come out on bond and then organized this thing. It was an act of extraordinary courage to go through that again, because obviously they were undergoing double jeopardy. And we took the files, the A1 files, which were the files of the most endangered of the young people. They would be drafted first. And we took them out of the building very carefully, because we didn't want to do a fire in a building. And we burned them in trash baskets in a parking lot outside, with homemade napalm, which was our symbol of the napalm being used on children and all sorts of people in Vietnam.
This was really a very radical act. What pushed you to actually breaking the law? Once you do that in a way, there's no turning back.
Yes, and I think, you know, we all realized at the time that our lives would never be the same again. Well, it was a combination of things. I think I had reached my limit, as Gandhi says, keeping the law as long as one conscientiously can, and testing the limits of the law through all sorts of legal activity. And then, as he advises, when that point comes where this is making no sense and getting nowhere, and the laws are manifestly unjust anyway, step over, which I did.
What was the reaction of the church and the reaction of your fellow Jesuits?
Well, it was extremely edgy. This was all terra incognita. You know, it was no person land, and nobody had done a thing like this in the history of the American order, though, of course, Jesuits had been jailed and murdered all through our history. But it was a cultural explosion in the States, because we had become, I think, extremely, well, safe people. And the real questions that I had learned elsewhere and had learned from history were not being raised here, because we were safe and prosperous. And so it became a very moot question as to whether or not I could survive in the order. And I did, by the skin of my teeth, and here I am.
Why do you think you did survive in the order? Why do you think that they never expelled you?
Well, there was quite an uproar in both directions. Officially, there was all sorts of stuff about, you know, get rid of him. And then there was a great upsurge among the younger Jesuits that were sort of walking with the objectors to the war by then. And I think the officials began to realize that this would create a totally unwanted storm, that someone would be evicted for conscientious activity against a horrible war. So the whole thing stopped short, just short. And yes, that was it.
For your actions in the Catonsville Nine, you were given a 3-year jail sentence.
Mm-hmm.
But you went underground, as did, I think, most of the other members of that group.
Yes.
Now, from the way you describe it in your autobiography, you didn't necessarily plan to go underground. You make it sound as if it were really a spur-of-the-moment decision.
Well, I may have given a wrong impression there. I don't recall exactly how I treated it. We did have extensive, thoughtful meetings about this whole question. I forget who of the eight survivors of the Nine first raised it. But it was not spur of the moment, really. It was very, very carefully considered and thought through. And as far as I recall, 4 of us decided to go underground and 4 submitted and went to jail.
Why did you choose to go underground?
Well, it was a terrible time, as probably you recall. The spring of 70, Nixon had invaded Cambodia. There were these days of rage all over the country. Kent State had occurred. There were killings of black students at Jackson State. The whole place was in great turmoil, and including Cornell, where I was teaching. And it just made no sense to me. It was just, we used the analogy at the time of somebody submitting to the jail as submitting before the draft. It was bowing before a totally illegitimate authority and giving up what you had first resisted. So we felt there was a certain moral continuity required here. Some of us felt that.
When you went underground, in a way, every time you stayed at somebody's house along the way, you were jeopardizing them because they could have come up under, criminal charges for harboring you.
Well, some did. Some did.
How did that make you feel, knowing that for the actions that you had taken, you were jeopardizing people who were close to you and strangers who were willing to help you?
It just seemed to me that the war was not my question, it was our question.
Mm-hmm.
And that I hadn't created the question, I was trying to respond to it. And that what was required here was not some individual, you know, wandering around. What was required was a community of resistance, and I was helping to build that through these fine people. And that was important for them as well as for me, because the legal jeopardy should, in the nature of conscience, should have been shared.
You felt that in a way it kind of strengthened their commitment to the movement.
Absolutely.
By taking a stand.
Oh, yeah.
And putting themselves,
yeah,
at risk.
And I was not their white man's burden. I was their conscience inviting them a little further. So I looked on the whole thing very cool. As, my undergoing this awful time, which was really wonderful too, was not the nature of a burden on them. It was in the nature of an opportunity.
How long were you underground?
I think it went, as far as I recall, from May until August of 70.
Did you have a lot of disguises?
I don't think there was any great effort. You know, the main thing was to travel sensibly and to keep reasonably out of sight. And again, to keep a discipline going, I did a lot of writing and made tapes and even preached once in a public church.
Well, no, I believe that the other three were captured.
They were captured
within
very
a week
quickly.
Or something. Yeah,
yes.
And you stayed underground for months.
Right.
What was your secret? I mean, what were you able to do that they didn't do to maintain your to remain hidden for so long?
I think I learned from each one of them at the time of their capture that I learned what not to do, and such things, for instance, as using the phone and traveling publicly and all that sort of thing, you know, or staying in very obvious places or homes, families that were already being surveilled, things like that. One didn't do those things if one wanted to go on.
Did you realize eventually you'd be caught?
Oh, sure. Because I had many opportunities simply to leave the country and wash my hands of the whole thing, and that was not the point of this. The point was to extend one's sort of escape, knowing it was temporary, and meantime raising the bloody question of the war in ways that you couldn't have from jail.
You were captured by two FBI agents?
Well, there was a whole coven of them disguised, if you can imagine it, as bird watchers on Block Island. The whole thing was so absurd. I mean, they're not really very smart, these people. They were in the midst of a nor'easter, a real gale, there in late August, and there they were in their slickers watching birds. There wasn't a bird for 100 miles, you know.
So you knew who they were? You figured that out?
Oh, right away, sure.
Let me ask you, when they were taking you in the car back to jail,
yeah,
did you try to talk with them about the war?
Well, there wasn't a great deal of opportunity. See, they brought me in a Coast Guard cutter from the island into Providence, and as I say, the seas were very stormy, and they were trying to protect me in the boat from any kind of physical harm. They didn't want any marks on me. And I say this storm was raging around us, and then they simply deposited me in a jail.
Well, I want to talk more with you about your life, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Daniel Berrigan, who's written a new autobiography. It's titled To Dwell in Peace. We'll take a short break, then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air. Daniel Berrigan is my guest. He's written a new autobiography titled To Dwell in Peace. Even when you were in jail after you were captured, you were very visible within the peace movement. You wrote letters from jail and, I believe, poems from jail that ended up getting published. So
yes.
You still had an important voice in the movement, even though physically you weren't present, even though physically you were behind
yes.
bars.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, you really became one of the stars of the peace movement. Now, what I'd like to know from you is, what do you think are the pros and cons of having almost celebrities within a political movement? I mean, I think it really became an issue in the 60s and early 70s because people really did take on not only leadership positions, but people became the media spokespeople
yes,
for the issues.
Yes.
So what do you think are some of the pros and cons of becoming one of those very visible people within a movement?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me say that, first of all, it's been a very difficult question, personally, and one that has always made me sort of, you know, run for the woods. This whole business of transforming a kind of moral voice or ethical voice or peaceable voice into this pumped-up absurdity called celebrity. And I think I've been able to sort of, you know, run around it or run through it or run by it pretty well, pretty well. But on the other hand, one can't simply renounce one's, I don't know what, one's voice or one's talent or maybe for helping people interpret the truth or turn a corner.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's a very thin line that I walk, you know. And I'm very glad for my family and for my community of Jesuits in helping me keep a kind of a human size in all of this, you know?
Yeah. You've written that being a Christian needs redefining in every age. Do you feel that in a way you're living in a different age now than you were in the 60s, and that you've had to redefine your commitment as a Christian, redefine the needs around you?
Well, I think, you know, the question you put is one way of putting everything, you know, the whole question. I grew up in a culture, let's say a religious culture, and in a family in which war was taken for granted as part of the human condition and part of the church's condition. And four of my brothers fought in the Second World War. We nearly lost several of them. But that was taken for granted. You went off. You went off, and you fought, and you died, and you killed, and the whole bloody litany went on. And the real before and after occurred, had to occur, and did occur, and is occurring, not just to me or my family or the Jesuits, but to the any thoughtful person, it seems to me, across the world, is saying, we're at a dead end. We're either going to get rid of all this trash, this lethal trash, or we're all going to go under. That necessarily has required enormous changes in the church, which, of course, during the Vietnam years was still lagging, way behind. We didn't hear anything official for 10 horrible years from the Catholic bishops. So what has occurred to me has occurred, it seems to me, to everybody except those who have, you know, just gone asleep and are sleepwalking in the world. And it really is something quite simple. We're being transformed from a war-making church to a peacemaking church. And that's almost a genetic change. I mean, it's terrific. I'm not saying or claiming that it's happening at large or that it's happening even to most Catholics, but it's happening where it was happening to nobody, including me, let's say 20 years ago.
Right now you're spending a lot of your time working with people who have AIDS.
Yes.
You're working in a New York hospital. What led you to that kind of work?
Well, I was working for about 5 years, beginning in the, let's say, around 80. I began working with the dying in a hospital in New York where we were taking only those who had no place to go, street people, addicts, alcoholics, destitute dying people. And then the AIDS epidemic began. New York really hit me about 4 years ago, and I said to myself, I think I better get with that. So I transferred to another hospital, St. Vincent's, where we have one of the pioneering hospice-type treatment centers in the country.
You know, I'm sure that a lot of the people that you're working with, since you are a religious man, ask you, how can God allow this epidemic to happen?
Yes.
How do you deal with questions like that?
Well, if I could just say this, I don't think that becomes, it's strange when I think about it, that's the big question. The big question for many of the young people I work with, because I work mainly in the homosexual community.
Mm-hmm.
This is the hospitals in Greenwich Village, and we don't have many drug people, so it's one kind of AIDS person. The bitterest question, and the one that really makes my work most difficult, is the attitude of the hierarchy and the church toward gay people. And so I come in under kind of jeopardy as a priest of a church that is pretty rigid and is extending its disapproval even to the very ill. And these people die under that cloud. I try my best to relieve the cloud by my own compassion, my own sense of myself and of them. But it's very hard going.
So you're a link to spiritual thought, even though the church might not condone homosexuality. You will, and you will be there for them.
Absolutely. And very much on their terms, that is to say, any kind of physical service, of shopping or cleaning, or simply holding somebody, or more specifically, religious activity. Some people want to pray with you or want communion brought. But I just like to be there on their terms.
You know, there are political issues involved with AIDS, issues of funding, issues of...
Of course.
Even issues of whether, like, if someone who is gay is dying, they're not legally allowed to be married. So there's issues of wills and things like that. So there are like legal, political issues. But for the disease itself, there's no one to take action against. You know what I mean? Like for the disease itself, you can't blame the government. You can't blame any kind of authorities. It's a really different kind of issue than war.
Well, of course, that's a very large topic. It just seems to me that the government is to be held responsible for the niggardliness and the tardiness of its response to this whole thing. We're involved in a permanent war economy, and the only ones that are getting fat are the generals. And the AIDS people can take the leavings or the gleanings or what's left over from all of this, but they're not a main issue any more than the homeless of New York are. So, in a sense, I feel that every human being, whether ill or well or gay or straight, if we are gifted with any kind of a conscience, we're all in the same boat. We're all on death row, or we're all condemned by these maniacs, and the boat is leaking, and the only thing we can do is row and bail and try to meet one another on a decent basis.
Well, we only have a few seconds left, but let me ask you very briefly to describe the religious community that you live in now.
Well, I live in a series of apartments on the Upper West Side with about 20 of our seminarians who are in studies in the graduate schools around and our priests. We have all sorts of professional people in the community who are doing good work in New York and across the country and teaching and counseling and working in welfare hotels and doing advocate law and medicine, and earning our living and paying our rent and undergoing the heat of New York, even in the winter, if you know what I mean.
I do.
Yes. Right.
Well, I want to thank you so very much for talking with
us. Thank you. It's been great.
Thank you for your time.
Okay.
My guest has been Daniel Berrigan, and he's a Jesuit priest and a social activist. He's spent time in prison for his acts of civil disobedience. He now works at an AIDS hospice in New York. He's written an autobiography, which is titled To Dwell in Peace. To Dwell in Peace is published by Harper & Row. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.